Over NBC's coast-to-coast network of independent affiliated stations, the University of Chicago Roundtable. Today, the Roundtable presents the second in a series of two programs on first-hand accounts of conditions inside the Soviet Union. Details of how you may secure printed copies of both programs will be announced at the conclusion of today's discussion. Today's Roundtable on A Businessman's Report on Russia presents Paul Cadbury, a British businessman, who as a member of the Quaker Mission of Moscow recently spent 3 weeks in Russia. Joining Mr. Cadbury in this roundtable discussion are two members of the University of Chicago faculty, Hans J. Margenthal, director of the Center for the Study of American Foreign Policy, and Louis Gottschalk, historian. And now, first, we hear Mr. Gottschalk.
Last week, the University of Chicago was fortunate in having as a guest lecturer Mr. Paul Cadbury, Vice President of Cadbury Limited of England. Mr. Cadbury was one of the group of Quakers who last summer went to Russia and whose interview with the Russian Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs, Yakub Malik, roused great interest at the time. The University of Chicago Roundtable took advantage of Cadbury's presence on the campus to interview him. The interview took the form of a conversation between him, Professor Morgenthau, and myself. We shall hear this conversation in just a minute. Before Mr. Cadbury speaks, I should like to point out that he is no ordinary observer of Russia. In the first place, he is a manufacturer and, as I gather, frankly a believer in enlightened capitalism. Secondly, he is a Quaker and has no sympathy with militarism, whether Russian, German, or other. Thirdly, he was the last liberal member of the Birmingham City Council and as a member of the Liberal Party, feels under no obligation to share the political and social views of either Clement Attlee's Labour Party or Winston Churchill's Conservatives. Finally, he is an Englishman, and therefore less likely than either a Russian or an American to take a one-sided view of the issues that have recently made the Cold War hotter. As an industrialist, a Quaker, a liberal, and an Englishman, Mr. Cadbury can be no fellow traveler. For that reason, some of his observations acquire a special interest. When he says that Russia is relatively prosperous economically and united politically, he is not in agreement with a notion current in some quarters in this country that Russia is on the point of collapse. When he expresses the opinion that the Russians are willing to take a peaceful attitude on the issue of German rearmament, he contradicts the common persuasion that the Russians want war. For the most part, his impressions corresponded with those that I received myself during a visit to Russia in 1933. But that was almost 20 years ago. A depression, a hot war, a cold war, and a Korean crisis have intervened. Yet it is a striking thing that unless I misread Mr. Cadbury's remarks, an open-minded traveler in 1951 found a spirit in Russia that apparently had not changed much in the years between 1933 and 1951. I, at least, am led to believe that if the spirit of Russia has not made astounding progress since the first five-year plan, neither has it deteriorated. Some of Mr. Cadbury's remarks, as you listen, may appear open to question or doubt. They did appear so to Morgenthau and me, but I shall allow Professor Morgenthau to speak for himself.
Regardless of the conclusions one draws from it, such a visit to the Soviet Union is eminently worthwhile, provided it is undertaken by honest and intelligent men. It is worthwhile on three different grounds. First, whatever one's philosophy or political aspirations are, all mankind is united in the desire to preserve peace. Perhaps it does little good, even no good at all, if the Russians hear from a group of obviously sincere and well-informed men, such as this Quaker mission, how the West thinks about peace. Certainly, it does no harm. Conversely, there can be no harm for us, and it may even do us some good to hear from such men how the Russians feel about peace. Secondly, whatever the Quakers could tell the Russian host about our economic, social, and political conditions and aspirations must have done some good. Finally, perhaps the most important contribution which a group such as the Quaker Mission can make is the information they can give us about the Soviet Union. We are woefully ignorant of conditions in Russia. It is true we can read Russian newspapers. We can analyze the statements of Russian leaders and of Russian propaganda. and we can listen to refugees and diplomatic reports from behind the Iron Curtain. But obviously, all those sources of information are of very limited value. For one reason or another, the individuals who bring us that information are handicapped in their search for the truth. It would of course be silly to deny that the Quaker mission was handicapped too, but it was certainly less handicapped than some others who have told us rather pleasing stories about the weakness of the Russian government, the backwardness of their economy, and the discontent of the people. The Quaker mission at least left its colored spectacles at home, and they enjoyed freedom of movement, both with regard to places and persons, which few other foreigners can have enjoyed in recent years. They tell us, for instance, that it does not look at all as though the Russians were ready to revolt against the government. Such a statement may not be conclusive, but it is certainly worth pondering. Cadbury, I turn to you. How did you find general conditions in the Soviet Union?
Well, I expected to find a country with fears and with poverty, ill-clad, ill-fed. And the thing that really surprised me, obviously in a short visit we couldn't see very much, but just watching ordinary people about in the street, was that they seemed so cheerful, so like ourselves. And instead of being ill-clad and ill-shod, I was surprised how nicely they were dressed, and I counted 100 people past me in the streets, for instance, and they were all well shod. And I think really the thing that's in my mind is that we are ignorant of conditions in their country, or have got the wrong idea of conditions, and they're even perhaps more ignorant of conditions in our countries. We were talking to a woman lecturer at Moscow University, and she was telling me about their social security, their old age pensions and their free medicine, and I made some such remark as that we in England had arrived at a similar end, but by a different route, by the route of evolution rather than revolution. And I was quite clear she just didn't believe me. I think for a variety of reasons, they believe we're in a Dickensian state in England. They read Charles Dickens very widely as a standard Russian classic in translation. The sort of picture he painted 100 years ago coincides with what they have been told still exists. Of course,
this is probably a general aspect of the Marxist preconceptions of what capitalism is like. After all, the capitalism Marx wrote about is fundamentally different from the capitalism which has developed in the last 100 years and of which Marx knew very little. But what about the alleged propensities of capitalism for war? What do you think about that?
Well, there we found a very real fear that America and her allies are arming, not as we say for peace, but in order to be able to prosecute war. I had one quite interesting example of that in that a man said that he had read the American financial newspapers and he'd formed the opinion that business was very frightened that the peace talks in Korea would succeed because of the possible economic crisis which might result. And he challenged me with that view, and I tried to persuade him that this was not the view of business, but it was quite clear a really intelligent man had formed that view, not by Russian propaganda, but by reading American newspapers.
But I wonder whether, Mr. Cadbury, it isn't true that that these people are nevertheless subject to a great amount of propaganda by the government. This man, of course, might have got his idea that American business was anxious to keep the war going in Korea for motives of profit from the American newspapers alone. But then if he had read other things in the American newspapers, he would have seen that we were fearful of inflation and that we were fearful of over domination of the government because of a war situation. And why didn't he pick on those things?
He might have, because I think he was a man who was obviously allowed to read what he liked. But ordinary people, of course, are not permitted to read information that is not approved. We've got to realize that we're dealing with a country with a controlled press. But what really impressed me with him is that I told him that my own experience as a businessman was not that I hated operating my business on an artificial market. I wanted to get back to the ordinary conditions of supply and demand. And I know I impressed him. It was a new point of view to him.
We all agreed that the Russian conceptions of the West are either obsolete, referring to an experience which is no longer true, or that they are the result of a blind belief in the Marxist dogma. Now, what about our preconceptions of what the Soviet Union is like? How did you size up life in the Soviet Union in view of our stereotypes? What, for instance, about your ability to move around in the Soviet Union as you liked? To what extent were your movements restricted, for instance?
Well, we asked to do a lot of things, and we had a rather full schedule, or as I should call it, schedule. But within that, we walked about Moscow as we liked, unaccompanied.
You had no experience of being followed by the secret police?
No, we expected to be, and I don't think we were.
But we weren't in 1933. We were able to walk around freely from place to place, although the in-tourist was rather insistent on accompanying us, even whether we wanted them or not. But wasn't your passport taken away from you?
Yes, but I think the freedom that impressed me most was that we were able and used our ability to go round to our own embassy when we wanted to, go to the Indian embassy, and see people in that way by ourselves.
You didn't have to ask for permission to go tomorrow morning to this place, tomorrow afternoon to another
several
place.
Times I walked out of the hotel myself and went to one of the embassies. I did it to the Indian embassy, for instance, where we knew the ambassador.
Now, what about the liberties of the Russian people themselves? Well, the lack of liberties.
Well, I believe there's a police check outside Moscow, and if you left the city in your car, you would have to give reason for leaving the area.
Did you find a large number of police on the corners?
Oh, yes.
And in the
tremendous.
And didn't you have the feeling that because of a peculiarity of dress or appearance or speech that you would be easily detected?
I don't think we could have got up to much mischief in Moscow, even if we'd wanted
to. Did you raise with anybody in Russia the problem of the freedom of the press or of slave labor?
Well, both those problems we raised. I'm bound to say we didn't ask to see the slave labor camps. We thought we should get off on the wrong foot. If we asked for something, we knew we should be refused. But on freedom of the press, they just don't know what we're talking about. I got two sentences in my mind, but surely the American government can stop a newspaper saying what it doesn't approve of. And another time I talked about freedom of the press, they said, but we've got freedom of the press. We can buy one of two or three papers, or we're free to buy none. They're ignorant of the fact that their press is a controlled press.
Well, and the ignorance, I think, is emphasized by the fact that they are permitted to criticize domestic economic arrangements. They can criticize their factory managers. They can criticize the lack of certain kinds of commodities, or am I wrong about
that?
Well,
they say they can, and they talk a lot about freedom to criticize, and freedom, in fact, is a word they use a great deal. I think it's all relative, you know. A country which has had very little freedom and gets a small measure of freedom, by our standards, very small, feels conscious of it.
I guess this would also be true of the standard of living, which I guess is much lower than ours, but still is much higher than it was in the past in the Soviet Union.
That, I think, is certainly true. I mean, I'm a bit of a farmer, and the land is being wonderfully well cultivated, whatever the justice or lack of justice of the collectivization of the farms, and this great increase in industrialization.
What about the efficiency of the plants which you visited?
Well, as a businessman, I tried to look out to see whether there were any non-productive labor about, or idle labor. And there were in the chocolate factory, which of course I knew a good deal about as a chocolate manufacturer, and in the motor car factory, I was very impressed that people were getting on with the job. Because every job is piece rated, and then you've got all sorts of bonuses and prizes on top of the piece rates.
Did you have any impression that the factories you saw were specially selected show places?
I think the
Potemkin Village.
Well, I think the motor car factory, the great Zeiss Works, probably was one of their show factories. But I was much more impressed because the chocolate factory wasn't. It was clean, they needn't be ashamed of it, but it was 20 years behind our practice technically. And the same thing, my colleague Leslie Metcalf, who went down a coal mine. It was not a show place at all.
I saw a factory in 1933, of course. That was at the end of the first five-year plan, and it probably was not as good a factory as they're able to make now. What impressed me the most was that every boy or girl we talked to at a machine, this was a lathing machine factory in Moscow, had only recently come off the farm. Now, that seems to me one of the things that we have to remember, that this is an agricultural country, that recently agricultural country that has suddenly become highly industrialized.
You mentioned that all Russian industry operates on the basis of peace rates. Now, we regard in this country peace rates to a considerable extent as synonymous with the exploitation of labor and certainly as a violation of the principle of equality.
Well, I know a fair amount about peace rates, and I was tremendously impressed. It's not only in factory, it's on the farm. Every farm worker seems to have some norm, and if they can increase on that, for instance, woman producing milk has so many gallons per cow per lactation, and if she can increase on that, she gets a very large money reward.
But didn't you raise the question of equality with some of the Russians who
talked about it? Of all places, at the headquarters of the trade union movement, they said to us, we do not believe in equality, to each man according to his ability. And, of course, that is another thing that strikes a visiting stranger, the tremendous number of this new wealthy privileged class of factory managers and professors and teachers and artists and so on.
Who make no attempt to hide their newly acquired wealth.
No, you see, in a country where there's no easy method of saving and where the direct taxation is very, very small, I think 10% is the maximum, people have really just got to spend it.